Using the heavy desk to block the door, the companions had raided the small armory, taking everything they could comfortably carry, especially bulletproof vests and the rocket launchers. They were very lightweight, only 10 pounds or so, and came with a strap for carrying them across the back. Spotting a first aid box on the wall, Mildred hurried over eagerly.
These assholes have been stealing everything they could for decades.
Not that it did them any good.
Now what?
Mildred took down a lever-action Winchester. Although it was the terror of the Old West in its day, now the rifle was considered slow and cumbersome. However, it was the only thing in the armory equipped with a telescopic sight. That could make a big difference.
Now we find out if the war has started yet.
Ryan headed back for the front office. Turning off the lanterns, the companions let their sight adjust to the darkness, then eased open the shutters to peek outside. Rows of armed men and women were across the street in the town square, receiving a speech from a woman standing inside a small gazebo. Behind the Sekhmen was a mob of women with wheelbarrows full of wicker baskets.
Christ, I feel like I'm going insane! A mowed lawn, water, sprinklers, bird baths, parking meters for God's sake! Never thought I'd live to see such things again.
Nor I, madam. A gazebo in the Deathlands is staggeringly disingenuous.
Shut the frag up. I can't hear what they're saying.
Mayor Spencer looked down at the crowd from the stage outside.
Yes, killed. Only feet away from where we stand. Deputy Ted Ellison, cowardly stabbed in the back by the very outsiders that we have locked in our jail.
Death to the bus riders! Hang them! Set them on fire and hang them!
Standing tall, Mayor Spencer appreciated the fervor of the people, but did not want this to become a lynching again. There were a lot of questions the outsiders had to answer before being allowed to die.
Ted Ellison is dead! He died so that we may live! So I want everybody to be extra careful about all that hot metal and the slippery floors. Gloves and shoes, remember that! Gloves and shoes at all times!
Sheriff McIntyre walked onto the stage.
Move fast and it's your ass! Furthermore, you must be doubly sure to never, ever hesitate!
Mayor? Your Honor? This is Station 9 to the mayor. Come in, please.
Turning away from the villagers so that they couldn't hear her over the microphone, Henrietta Spencer pulled out the radio and thumbed the button.
This is the mayor. Go 9.
Ma'am, there's a... hell, I don't know what the fuck it is. The damn thing looks like a steam locomotive, and it's coming this way.
Look, there are no tracks in the clover.
It's got wheels.
Okay, we'll still steam them in the tunnel like all the other invaders. Why are you wasting my time like this?
It's not in the fucking clover. This thing is on the other side of the Barrier River. It's coming from the east. Did you hear me? The east.
Okay, it's to the east. Who cares? Unless they have wings or brought along a bridge.
They did.
Come again? They did what?
A bridge. The people operating the locomotive brought along a motherfucking bridge. It sort of looks like the box trestle from the Mud Lake, and they're trying to shove it across the barrier to reach our side.
They dragged the whole bridge here?
Yes, ma'am, and they're trying to push it across. Plus a lot of other vehicles, too. Every goddamn one of them carrying machine guns and all kinds of military hardware. They're gonna be on our side in only minutes.
It must be Broke Neck Pete.
I swear, if this is some sort of a joke...
Just then, a fiery dart shot into the eastern sky, and everybody turned to stare in growing horror as the missile came streaking down. Hundreds of lights appeared in the darkness, and people began running madly in the streets.
Jesus Christ, Mayor! I think that was a missile!
Shut the fuck up! Command and control, this is Spencer. Give me audio. Repeat, this is Spencer. Give me audio now!
Now hear this! Now hear this! Red alert! Repeat, red alert! This is not a drill! All mothers, get your children into the bunkers! All children, to the bunkers immediately! The village is under attack!
Sheriff McIntyre pressed the button on his own radio.
Everybody else to your post! Arm all weapon systems and prime the defensive grid. Repeat, this is not a drill. The goddamn bus riders are coming over the bridge, boys. It's time to bail or fail.
The huge searchlights on the wall came into operation, the intense beams sweeping the land outside the village, looking for targets.
Steam! They're going to ace Roberto with steam!
Millie, can they do that?
Hell yes. If the boilers can build enough pressure, they could blow War Wag 1 out of that tunnel like spitting out a watermelon seed, and the heat would parboil the crew, acing them while still inside the wag.
Without harming the brass or fuel. Fire blast.
That was why the tunnel had been so clean. It had to get used on a regular basis. This whole thing had been a jack from the very beginning. Cascade sending out Yates, or rather McIntyre, as a phony doomy to confirm the fake journals. It was a double lie. They had to have sent out dozens of the damn things, maybe hundreds, hoping to draw in a traitor or two. They had caught a lot more than that, and now it was time for the harvest. Harvest. The word burned in Ryan's mind like a white flame of hate. Suddenly, another missile rose high to arch back downward again.
Pete is trying to get the range of the wall. Once he does, it will come down faster than the fabled walls of Jericho.
That's when the rads will really hit the Geiger.
Not our problem. Let Pete keep these bastards busy while we find the boilers and shut them down. Mildred, any idea where they could be located?
No idea whatsoever. City Hall must have a big furnace, and the high school an even bigger one. Not either of those should have the sheer volume needed to take out a convoy of war wags.
The companions ferociously studied the map. There was nothing there marked command or defense grid or steam generator or anything useful.
Gaia, I know where the damn thing is. Remember the dirt road that cut through the cropland? The bare dirt road that went straight from the tunnel to the Ville wall?
Dark night. That must be the feeder pipe. The heat killed the grass and crops along the whole length, so they just turned the bald section into an access road.
Then the boilers must be right on the other side of the wall, which would put them between
right
the silos
there,
and the water.
Smack between the grain silos and the water reservoir.
There was a large square on the map, but no name or description. Going to the desk, Mildred opened the top drawer and hauled out a phone book.
Careful, Millie. Those pages are mighty yellow.
Always were. Okay. That is the location for Cascade Shipping and Delivery. That's why you couldn't find it on the map, John. Cascade is the name of the local truck depot.
Makes sense. When Skydark hit, there was probably more canned and frozen food stored there waiting to be shipped out than in all the homes and markets combined. The depot would have meant life itself to the locals for decades.
While the world starved, they supped on a cornucopia of frozen TV dinners.
Exactly.
And now it's their military headquarters.
Which means it will be full of armed SecMen.
Not anymore, dear lady. They will all be on the wall fighting off Brokeneck Pete, the enemy of my enemy.
They're still my fucking enemy, but one fight at a time. First we save Roberto and his people. Then we'll decide what to do about Pete.
Do, sir?
After what we've seen, he can fucking have Cascade. Hell, the bastards deserve each other.
Wait a minute. I got an idea.
JB started running down the corridor.
Be right back.
A few moments later, a smoky JB returned, holding his munitions bag.
Okay, let's go.
On the streets outside, the companions stayed in the shadows as several jeeps raced by. The grim crew inside each military transport, armed with an M60 machine gun, Law rocket launcher, or a flamethrower. Alongside the office was a large camo-colored Hummer. Incredibly, the door was unlocked. Sliding behind the wheel, JB reached under the dashboard and yanked out some wires, then touched them together. Lying curled on the floor mat, Mildred passed up a cigar box she found below the front seat.
It'll help hide your face.
Gratefully, JB pulled out a homemade cheroot. He began to head across town for the large, well-illuminated building, surrounded by a barbed wire fence, guard dogs, and concrete pillboxes.
Fire blast. There's no way we can get through all of that in time. We'll have to try another way. Okay, head for the wall. We gotta find some stairs, and fast.
Going to attack from the roof?
Something like that.
Ryan pulled a grin from his pocket and removed the tape from around the arming lever. A group of deputies running along the sidewalk looked curiously at the racing Hummer, and one of them started talking into a radio.
How will attacking the roof gain us access to the boilers in the basement?
It won't, and that's the whole damn point.
The moment that the box trestle had been shoved across the river gorge, Pete had sent over the lightweight delivery vans as a vanguard. As expected, most of them disintegrated in the field of landmines, but a few reached the forest, only to be halted. There was no pathway or road through the dense grove of pine and poplar. It was a solid barrier, a living wall of wood more than 100 feet wide.
Again! Hit him again!
In the rear of the massive APC, a dozen crewmen were preparing their weapons for the coming fight, a large dark-haired woman standing among them. Helga stood between them, slinging a canvas bag full of spare ammo belts and the M60 rapid-fire over his shoulder.
Remember what I told you. Once inside the Ville, no more chilling. Wound a blind only, but no chilling. We need these folks alive to talk.
Yeah, we'll make them talk, Chief.
Sure, have fun, rape all you want, but only after we have control of the Vill. Only then. Anybody dies before then, and I'll sell your asses to the Cannies. Capiche?
Yeah, we savvy.
Wrapped in a thick blanket, a doomy child sat alone in the corner on a wooden crate of MRE envelopes. With infinite patience, the mutie waited for the swirling whirlpool of events to finally coalesce into a single moment of clarity. The future was in motion again, forming and changing like warm quicksilver, each pattern new and distinct, but all of them rich with a terrible red hue of human suffering. Untold hundreds would perish tonight, and the child privately wished that he could be among them, to end the long years of forced servitude to his horrible master.
Again! Use every rocket, but bring down those fragging trees!
By now, most of the grove was on fire. Once the way was clear, Pete would personally drive Roadhog to the wall and punch through with his small supply of CG missiles. That wasn't the name of the Predark weapon, just what he personally called them. There didn't seem to be any designation for the oversized launchers except the name of the manufacturer, Carl Gustav. The massive 87mm rockets packed twice the punch of a slim 66mm Law and completely blew apart every war wag he had ever encountered, as if it were made of window glass instead of welded steel. The trader had only three of the CG launchers left, but they should be more than enough to open a crack in the wall around Cascade, and then the pipe bombs stolen from Tucsonville would finish the job. Pete had been hoarding the heavy anti-tank launchers for years, hoping to use them against the legendary trader. But now Pete was offered an even better target than revenge, the combined tech of the Predark world. And it was all waiting for him behind a simple stone wall. Brokeneck Pete, the first emperor of Nuke America. Soon, oh so very soon, the city of Cascade would be his. It was only a matter of minutes. The companions charged out of their vehicle and started up the enclosed stairwell leading to a guard kiosk. A deputy sat on the steps smoking a cheroot, and his eyes went wide at the appearance of Ryan and the others. Ryan aimed his Sig Sauer without slowing. Mercy was a luxury they could ill afford at the moment. Time was short. He encountered no more guards on the zigzagging stairs, and he paused halfway up the tower. The damn electrocution had taken more out of him than he wanted to admit. Glancing out a narrow slit in the brickwork, Ryan silently cursed at the sight of several jeeps full of armed people stopping near the van and surrounding the vehicle.
So much for protect and service. They'll be coming up the stairs next, John.
Already on it.
JB kneeled on the concrete. Stretched across the landing, a dark string was looped around the iron pipe railing of the stairwell and attached to the pin of a Gren, with the arming lever already removed.
Anti-purse?
Willie Peter. The chem storm will make a wall of fire and stop anybody from coming this way for quite a while.
Thermites would be better.
True, but I'm saving that for Pete.
But what about the implode grid?
We have other plans for that.
Ryan started up the stairs once more. Reaching the top landing, the companions angled their rapid fires toward the closed wooden door at the top of the stairs. Ryan charged up the last few steps and swept the kiosk with the rapid fire. Catching two deputies in the act of closing their bulletproof vests, Ryan stumbled to a mounted gun and aimed at the top of the wall. Men and women fell away into the darkness of the night. Meanwhile, the others aimed their M16 rapid fires down at the guards walking patrol on top of the depot. When the belt ended, Ryan released the hot gun and went outside. Walking swiftly along the top of the wide stone wall, he kept a good distance from the coils of electrified barbed wire.
By the three Kennedys!
Expecting a new attack, Ryan glanced to where Doc was pointing, but only saw a fiery warbird climbing high into the starry sky, going almost straight up.
Holy fuck.
It was rising from the west, not the east. It was the signal from Jack, which meant that Roberto was already here. Redoubling his speed, Ryan swung the rapid fire at anything that moved in the darkness ahead. Maintaining flanking positions, the rest of the companions stayed close above the depot. Mildred used the telescopic sight of the Winchester to aim at anybody coming their way with heavy ordnance. Turning away from the defense complex, Ryan aimed at the strands of barbed wire. Now looking down, he could see the dirt road going directly from the Vill to the craggy foothills in the west.
I got it!
Christy crouched to point her M16 toward the machine gunner in the kiosk. As if in response, a blinding searchlight swung around to trap the companions in a deadly zone of visibility. Everybody swung their rapid fires toward the source of the light. Ensconced in blackness once more, JB hauled out the Implogren, pulled the pin, and simply dropped the bomb over the outside edge of the wall. The feral sphere vanished into the gloom below, and the companions dropped, holding on tight. Running people were hurrying along the top of the wall, coming ever closer, when there came a brief flash of light from below. Caught by surprise, the deputies were hauled into the barbed wire. With the wind eased, Ryan stood and dropped a Willy Petergren off to the side. The chemstorm revealed a huge crater in the dirt road, 10, maybe 20 feet deep, but there was no sign of the feeder pipe.
Gaia, they're getting ready to release the steam!
Use the rockets!
Ryan tossed aside the rapid fire and pulled the law off his shoulder.
All together! We have to hit it all together!
Moving fast, everybody obeyed, spreading out slightly to assume a firing position.
On my mark!
Ryan placed a finger on the button, the plastic launch tube cool against his sweaty cheek.
3, 2, 1, mark!
Huge volumes of dirt were thrown aside in a dark tidal wave, along with several large chunks of curved steel pipe.
Run!
Suddenly, a geyser of white steam erupted, reaching for the stars, quickly spreading like a blossoming hellflower to send a boiling mist across the Ville and Propland. The companions barely made it inside the kiosk. A rain of boiling death fell over the wall and Ville. Long before the fires were completely extinguished in the barrier forest, the steam truck Thunder had crashed into the charred branches, smashing them aside to create a path for the other wags. In tight formation, the LVTP-7 Roadhog had come next, closely followed by the speedy little delivery vans, the halogen headlights throwing out overlapping cones of bright illumination. Rolling through a wide cornfield, the steam truck reached the city wall without incident and stopped just short of touching the paved road encircling the Ville. Pete fingered the leather brace supporting his neck as he studied their surroundings.
Strange, they're not firing.
Maybe they're all chilled. That boiling rain must have aced anybody out there in the open.
Possible, but I strongly dislike coincidences.
Pete turned to address the Doomy, but the child was rocking back and forth, lost in the secret world of his mind.
All right, let's circle the place and find the gate. Have Thunder and the vans go left, we'll go to the right. Whoever finds the gate, radio the others before trying to gain control.
Who knew? Maybe Pete could take the place intact and use it as his new base, rather than merely looting the tech and hauling it hundreds of miles to his home outside St. Louis.
What about the CG launches, Pete?
Keep them ready in case Roberto made it across the Mud Lake. But with any luck, he's in the belly of a Kraken by now.
Along with a triple-cursed bitch.
Exiting from the brick kiosk, the companions stumbled along the wall, the granite slippery with small puddles, the dense air heavy with moisture. The top of the barrier had been cleared of everything. Corpses, guns, brass, and blood. And most of the barbed wire along the western side of the wall was gone, the tangled strands ripped free from their insulated moorings. But the Ville below was strewn with bodies. Norms, horses, and dogs. The sagging trees dripping water. The shiny streets misty with steam. Every torch and oil lantern had been extinguished. Only the electric streetlights were still functioning, the stark white glow harshly displaying the stark desolation. Cascade was a city of the dead. Nothing was moving for as far as the companions could see, aside from rivulets of water flowing into the storm gratings of the street. The scattered fires were extinguished, dark smoke rising upward to merge with the starry sky. Then, dozens of doors opened in the houses and stores, and out poured armed townsfolk. They milled around aimlessly at first, unsure of what to do or where to go. Then the mob surged toward the Ville Square, converging upon the gazebo like iron filings drawn to a powerful magnet. A stocky woman took the wet stage and began to shout orders too faint to hear from atop the wall. But the crowd took heart and rushed to obey. First, the dead were checked for ammo and grins. Then every vehicle was started and driven to the massive southern gate to form a curved line in front of the portal. More cars were added, along with jeeps, trucks, and oddly, bales of hay, until there was a wide span solidly blocking the main street. Then the people took defensive positions behind the makeshift barricade and waited for the coming invaders.
That isn't even going to slow down, Pete.
Don't think it'll have to. Look there.
A large group of people stood at the iron gate of the bunker, the golden hair of Jessica Cold visible even from this great distance.
Jack must have told him how to find that trick door. It's nice to have reinforcements, but I'm not really sure how 50 more folks on foot are going to stop war wags. Are they carrying bazookas?
Don't need them.
War Wag 1 suddenly rolled through the jagged opening in the rock face of the granite foothills, the rocket pod trailing smoke. It was closely followed by the UCV and Big Joe.
War Wag 2 is still alive? Excellent!
I thought so. Option 16, my ass. No traitor ever gives up without a fight.
This will help a lot. But without the laser to even the odds, Roberto is in for a hell of a fight.
No problem there. I found this in the safe of the sheriff's office.
JB pulled on the drawstrings and opened the pouch.
These are the diamonds that Yates stole.
Superlative, John Barrymore. But however can we get these to Roberto? It's a 30-foot drop to the ground and impossible to get through the villa and the gate.
We can check the kiosks for some rope.
Don't worry about it, Millie. See here on the pouch? It's marked War Wag 1.
So what? Isn't that the pouch taken from War Wag 1?
Yep, sure is.
But then... Oh.
But then why would it be marked that way unless there were more diamonds in the other wags?
Only a fool keeps all of his brass in one pocket, especially for something as important as a can opener.
By Godfrey! The man said that we would never know all of his secrets, and it seems that Roberto was a man of infinite resources.
Traitors are trickier than a bent dick dog.
However, knowing Pete, it's still a long way from a fair fight.
Maybe we can do something about that. JB and Mildred, go left. Find some more law rockets in the other kiosks. Doc and Christy with me. The last thing either Roberto or Pete will expect is help from the segment of Cascade.
Let us away!
And everybody took off at a full run. Staying off the dirt path and safely in the field of corn, the convoy of wags crushed a wide path through the plants until reaching the paved road. Then they paused and headed in different directions, the UCV and Big Joe going left, War Wag 1 heading to the right. Glancing across the ville, Ryan wondered if Pete was doing the same thing, then dismissed the matter and concentrated on finding some rocket launchers. Down in the cornfield, the UCV and the Big Joe turned the corner of the wall and instantly launched missiles at the distant headlights of Thunder. The steam truck promptly responded in kind, and fiery warbirds lanced through the darkness. The wags turned off their headlights. Unexpectedly, a group of Cascade Outriders stood in the corn, carrying the lumpy canvas bag of a U.S. Army satchel charge, a sizzling fuse dangling from the side. As the UCV headed directly for the people to run them over, Big Joe unleashed a flamethrower. The deputies were engulfed in the arching spray of burning fuel. Swiftly, the urban combat vehicle darted away from them and the satchel charge. On the other side of Cascade, the door to one of the kiosks was suspiciously ajar, and Ryan had the others stop outside. He tossed in a grin, with the safety tape and arming pin still securely in place.
Go, 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 go!
Then, holding their rapid fires, the three companions stepped into the doorway. Inside, they checked for any laws. They found two lying near the gun ports, the plastic tubes riddled with ricochets. Continuing along the wall, Ryan and the others reached the corner, just in time to see an outrider astride a horse launch a law rocket at War Wag 1. Instantly, Roberto responded. The rocket exploded in midair. Just then, Roadhog came into view from around the distant corner. There was barely a tick of the clock before both war wags cut loose with everything they had. With the radar still down, Roberto had to aim by sight alone. Again and again, the shimmering laser stabbed out, but each time it missed Roadhog and only burned a deep groove along the granite wall. The driver turned off its headlights, and dark smoke began to gush from the squat machine attached to the rear of the LVTP-7. 40-millimeter Gren launchers started pumping out fat canisters. Once more, War Wag 1 tried the laser, but if it hit anything, it was impossible to say. In only moments, the cornfield was a roiling cloud bank, the thick chemical fumes merging with the West Virginia night, until it was impossible to see anything more than a few feet away. Farther down the wall, a powerful searchlight began to sweep the field, the beam dimly piercing the cloud bank and highlighting Warwag 1. Promptly, Roadhog launched a salvo of homemade rockets, and Roberto lurched his wagon to reverse, moving deeper into the swirling smoke. Ryan, Christie, and Doc aimed their weapons at the searchlight. In darkness again, both Warwags searched for each other. Ducking inside a brick guard kiosk, JB and Mildred found several unconscious deputies lying on the wet floor, their hands and faces covered with blisters. While JB grabbed a bandolier of 40mm shells off a particularly large deputy, Mildred forced herself to step past the men to check the closet, and was rewarded with a brace of Law rocket launchers. Rushing outside, Mildred and JB unleashed their weapons at the colossal thunder. Unexpectedly, Jack revved the tandem engines of the UCV to charge toward a delivery van. The civilian wag tried to escape. The steel fork of the UCV slammed into the sheet metal chassis, skewering it like a fish. Still in motion, Jack cycled the fork upward and behind until the crumpled van full of men fell off. The crew of Thunder then headed straight for the UCV, grimly intent on a fast kill. Easily outdistancing the steam truck, Jack destroyed the second delivery van with a fork, and he chased the third directly into the guns of Big Joe. Freed from the distraction of the vans, the UCV and the Big Joe started circling Thunder. The huge steam truck fired two more rockets, but then stopped, its small stockpile depleted.
The damn thing is finally out of rockets.
They still have plenty of brass. And if all else fails, it can simply ram the UCV and smash it like an empty can.
The bastard's gotta catch him first.
JB aimed his grenade launcher at the smoking flue on Thunder. Amazingly, it hit the small opening perfectly, but bounced off, the flue well protected by a wire screen. Deciding to try for the wheels, Mildred aimed her Law. Suddenly, she looked backward to see the horribly blistered deputies lurching out of the kiosk, their faces smeared with the pinkish lotion and shaking hands holding guns and knives. Grimly, Mildred turned the aft end of the Law toward the men. JB turned away from the slaughter to aim the M16 combo again at the apparently unstoppable Thunder. On a hunch, JB then focused on a water pump. A frothy column of cool water shot into the air. But if the cold deluge affected the hot engine of Thunder in any way, it wasn't readily apparent. Lowering the fork until it was nearly touching the ground, Jack spun the UCV crazily, then charged for the steam truck.
What in blazes is he doing? Jack can't dent that steam truck. It must weigh 100 times more than the UCV.
That's not the plan.
Crouching low, Jack fishtailed away from the blazing guns and slammed into the side of Thunder. Only skimming the ground, the fork went under the thick armor and stabbed three of the military tires, deflating them instantly. Twisting the steering wheel and braking sharply, Jack managed to rip the tires completely off, the spinning steel rims now several feet off the cropland. Charging back into the night, Jack cycled the fork behind the UCV to rub the tires off the fork. With the fork back in its lowered position, Jack charged the massive steam truck again, this time taking away only 2 tires. But the overweight Thunder was starting to list, and it slowed considerably. Encouraged, Scott swung Big Joe far around the 2 combatants, then charged in from the right. Moving at its maximum speed, the armored Mack truck hit the locomotive. As the vehicle tilted dangerously to the side, the driver tried desperately to correct the angle, the steam engine hammering to full power. As stubborn as a bulldog, the Big Mack truck clung to the job. Then, from out of the darkness, the UCV also rammed into the steam truck right alongside Big Joe, the fork raised as high as it could go. Speeding away from the toppled giant, Jack raced for cover as Big Joe's last missile went straight down the smoking flue. The UCV and Big Joe left the wrecked steam wag behind and reached the paved road around the ville. JB and Mildred dashed along the wall in hot pursuit. 4 down, left only 1 to go. Specifically, Brokeneck Pete and his unstoppable juggernaut, Roadhog. Endlessly racing around each other in the thick smoke, Warwag 1 and Roadhog charged through the dark cornfield. Explosions filled the night, but the laser stayed mute, and no missiles or rockets were launched. Those big punch weapons were wisely being saved for a clear target. Pelting into the next kiosk, Ryan, Christie, and Doc found only dying people and a flamethrower. It was a top-notch weapon against people, but utterly useless against a war wag. However, the closet yielded the unusual prize of a Stinger missile. Designed to destroy airplanes, the device had a fantastically long range, and more importantly, was a heat seeker, and should be able to zone in on the hot engines of the hidden war wag.
Gaia, this damn thing is useless!
Indeed, madam. It could just as easily terminate Roberto instead of Pete. It has no way of knowing which wag we want chilled.
Not if we launch it close enough.
Ryan turned on the old circuits, and the ready lights flashed brightly. Returning to the outside, Ryan, Christie, and Doc stared into the swirling fog, trying to find Roadhog. The Stinger was jerked out of Ryan's grip to tumble away toward the chemical fog. Spinning in unison, the three companions aimed their weapons. The brick kiosk was larger than other guardhouses, with no door in front to allow access to the wall, and wide sheets of steel were bolted to the brickwork as additional protection. There were two 50-caliber machine guns jutting from firing slots, along with a flamethrower, and what looked like a missile pod on the roof. This was Cascade's main defense post. Just then, the disfigured face of McIntyre briefly appeared in the gunport, his mottled skin covered with ugly blisters, one eye completely closed from a sagging fold of seared flesh. Instinctively, the companions dove for cover. Then they crawled back into the kiosk, and Ryan, Christie, and Doc aimed their guns again.
We will never ace him from here. Christie and I will keep him busy while you use the stairs and get him from behind.
I got a better idea.
Ryan stood with the flamethrower in his hands. Shoving the fluted muzzle out the gun port, he squeezed the firing lever. A stream of napalm lanced out to completely engulf the other master kiosk, liquid fire dripping off the brick and entering through every tiny crevice. McIntyre covered his face with both hands and fell from view. The companions rushed over to the master guardhouse and looked in through a firing slot. The walls were lined with rapid fires and missile launchers, as well as wooden racks filled with grens of all types. A dozen dead men were lying on the ground, their blistered hands and faces showing how they had painfully died. But there was no sign of Sheriff McIntyre.
Bastard escaped again.
The man is a Houdini!
Christie was about to reply when she was nearly overwhelmed with an imposing sense of danger. Moving her gun slowly, she tried to feel the direction of the approaching trouble, but she could barely concentrate. Barely slowing, the rear doors of Roadhog opened, and Helga jumped out, carrying a CG launcher. She raced away from the war wag, a second launcher slung uncomfortably over her back. If the little Doomy was right, all she had to do was to stay right there, and when Roberto rolled into view, she would put a missile straight through his windshield and end this death dance once and for all. But as she assumed a firing stance, Helga felt her animated hair flex wildly as if there were danger nearby, and she swung around to face the murky Ville. She could only dimly see the high wall through the dense clouds, but her gut told her that was the source of the real trouble. Without hesitation, Helga raised the CG and blindly took aim.
Christie?
Without answering, the scowling redhead aimed her M16 into the smoke. And a huge fireball pushed back the cloud bank to expose the aft end of Roadhog. Instantly, Ryan triggered the flamethrower and covered the armored war wag from stem to stern in blazing napalm. Silhouetted in the flames, Roadhog became starkly visible, and from out of the fog came a shimmering beam of translucent power that struck the armored prow. Superheated in under a split second, the bolts and welds broke, and the armor cracked free.
Nuke in hell!
Brokeneck Pete charged for the exit, but the little Doomy reached out to cling to the man with a death grip. Savagely, Pete backhanded the child away, and he hit the bulkhead hard. But even as the boy's eyes closed in death, a smile touched his lips, as a single moment later, Roberto fired the laser once more, this time sweeping it across the cornfield, cutting off the tufted tops of the cornstalks, and neatly slicing Roadhog in two. Not completely satisfied, Roberto launched one last salvo of missiles at the smoking pile of wreckage. Driving his dented war wag to the front gate, Roberto stopped the armored vehicle a few yards away from the suspiciously smooth sand in front of the wide portal. Experimentally, Jack flashed the headlights. Surprisingly, the gate swung ponderously aside, and there stood Mayor Spencer holding an oil lantern. She was soaked to the skin, and her right arm was in a sling, her hand covered with thick white bandages. Close behind her was a mob of armed men carrying a wide assortment of blasters and wearing flak jackets, but all of the men were either teenagers or wrinklies. The side door to Warwag 1 cycled down, and Roberto stepped into view. Jessica and Quinn flanked the big man, rapid fires filling their hands.
All right, you win. The village belongs to you. Come on in.
Thanks. But if you think I'm feeb enough to drive my wag through the gate, then you've been smoking wolf weed. You folks can generate electricity, and I'm betting live brass that there's enough hard current running through the entrance to fry a kraken like a catfish.
There was an uneasy stir among the villagers.
That's pretty smart for a bus rider.
I can say the same thing for you, Baron.
Baron? I am not some inbred noble, but a duly elected representative of the people.
That sounds pretty fancy. Me, I'm just a trader. And you're the president?
Mayor.
Fair enough. The name is Roberto Eagleson, but you already know that from your spy.
Etta. Henrietta Spencer. And you should know that the whole damn village is mined. Packed with enough TNT and dynamite to blow us to the moon.
Sounds like a mighty wise precaution. However, now that Pete is aced, we control the bridge and the tunnel. So while we can't get in, you can't get out.
Stalemate.
Why should we leave? Don't need to leave. We've got plenty of stores, enough to last for decades.
Well, you suckered us here with a lie and a spy, with the obvious idea of jacking my wags. Now, the plan works so slick that I'm guessing this was not your first time. Which tells me the Ville is dangerously low in supplies.
Except for blasters. Damn, you folks got a lot of heavy iron. I'll give you that.
The crowd took heart at the compliment, which was the general idea. Brass was a lot harder to make than a fair deal.
We can defend ourselves.
As can we. I'm sure that you've seen our laser in action. We made it ourselves.
Bullshit.
And why should we lie about that?
No reason I can think of.
You're tough, we're tough. Everybody here is harder than boiled steel. Fair enough. That means it would be triple stoop for us to fight anymore. So, let's talk.
About what?
Business. My business is buying and selling things. Plasters, brass, shine, juice, tech, books, food, you name it. I have it, or I can get it for you.
The trader walked forward, letting them see his pronounced limp.
Everybody needs something. Maybe we can cut a deal.
What kind of a deal are we talking about here? What do you want?
As he had done before, 1,000 times in his many journeys, Roberto Eagleson spread his arms wide.
What have you got?
A rosy dawn slowly came over the Blue Ridge Mountains, the sky gradually changing to a rare, clear blue, carrying the promise of a better tomorrow. Standing on the sooty edge of the wide hole, Mildred kicked a piece of charred wood into the smoldering rubble and tried not to weep. Gone. It was all gone.
You okay, Millie?
Yeah, John. I'll be fine.
The physician was unable to take her sight off the terrible destruction. The village hospital had been hit by a missile and burned to the ground. There was nothing remaining of any conceivable use to anybody but the gravediggers. The remainder of the night had been spent in lengthy negotiations between Roberto and Mayor Spencer, and then the careful exchange of goods, scrupulously watched over by numerous armed guards from both sides. Cascade got all of the food that Roberto could spare, while he received ammunition, fuel, a lot of books, and a laundry list of assorted items that the mayor wanted. Seeds for crops, fertilizer, batteries, salt, whiskey, something called Freon, silver jewelry, and good quality bedsheets. The last two items the trader privately knew were essential for making fulminating gun cotton, a tremendously powerful explosive, as he used the same things for the same purpose himself. The locals also agreed to build a new bridge over the gorge at Mud Lake, a wooden bridge that could easily be burned by either side if it was deemed necessary. Blood had been spilled on both sides, so there was an awkward peace between the trader and Ville that could change at any moment, especially if the locals obtained some major firepower. Roberto would have to make sure that they did not. Scott Gordon and Big Joe had already agreed to establish a post in the Field of Clover to monitor any visitors. The bridge over the Barrier River was already down, accidentally destroyed by a random missile, which saved him from blowing it apart and pretending that one of Pete's crew had done it as a last act of revenge on the Ville. Personally, Roberto wanted everything to be square and on the level. However, Cascade had lasted 100 years by stealing from other traders, an unforgivable sin from anybody else except these isolated hermits. Jacking Outlanders would be a hard habit for them to change. Cascade was a ticking time bomb, but one packed with the most priceless treasure of all, knowledge. So Roberto accepted the gamble. Taking risks was part of the job of being a trader. Washed and cleaned, the UCV was parked in the town square, taking on the last of their cargo. As the companions part of the deal, they got the UCV completely refueled by the local juice extracted from coal, and the war wag was packed solid with cases of preserves, an encyclopedia, a law, and a well-cushioned box full of pigeon eggs. In exchange, the mayor got the radio and the radar. It was considered by all to be a fair swap.
So where are you folks headed? You don't have to go solo. You're more than welcome to roll with us.
Thanks, Jessica, but we need to see some old friends at Front Royal. They want to know about Cascade. Maybe set up some regular trade. Front Royal could send over food and raw materials, and Cascade could use their machine shops to convert the metal into needed engine parts, chains, gears, and such.
Any sign of McIntyre?
No, he's long gone, along with a lot of explosives. The mayor has ordered him to be shot on sight. I guess nothing ticks off a former thief more than getting jacked.
Cervantes would most certainly agree, dear lady. He said that to steal from a thief is not a crime, merely irony.
Guess that all depends on whether or not it was your stuff in the first place.
Too true, dear lady. Well said.
Anyway, Roberto wanted to say goodbye, but he's busy with the mayor. Now, if truth be told, I won't mind seeing you disappear over the horizon. You folks attract trouble the way blood does stingwings. But I wish you luck. And if we ever cross paths again, the first shot of shine is on me.
Good to know.
Ryan smiled, then shook hands with Jessica Colt. As the companions dutifully climbed into the UCV, JB took his turn behind the steering wheel, and Ryan went to the gunner seat. It was a long journey to Front Royal, but there was brass in their pockets, food in the backpacks, and juice in the wag. In the Deathlands, that was as good as life ever got. However, in the far distance, dark clouds were beginning to gather over the Blue Ridge Mountains, heralding the approach of a storm. The high winds were increasing, and sheet lightning was already slashing at the jagged mountain peaks. Stumbling out of the sewer, Sheriff Dale McIntyre collapsed on a rock on the shore of Mud Lake. There was a cloth tied around his head to cover his ruined eye. Every inch of his body was bruised, and he was bone-weary. Too damn exhausted to run anymore, even if chased by the devil himself.
At least I got out of the city.
The sheriff shrugged off a backpack full of stolen canned goods and ammunition. When Roberto and his cold hearts took over, the very first people they would have hanged would be the mayor and the sheriff. Maybe his ancestor had been the hero of Skydark, but Dale was a lot more practical. Unless he got something out of it personally, he saw no reason to help anyone else. Just then, McIntyre saw a flicker of motion out of the corner of his eye. He spun with his gun ready, then paused in horror at the sight of the massive hellhounds, the tentacles sprouting from their muscular backs, waving as if tasting the air. They started forward, but then stopped abruptly at the sight of the badge on the man's uniform. It was a star, the symbol of the Makers. This was clearly one of their creations, or perhaps even a master himself. Sweat dripping off his blistered face, his gun hand trembling, Sheriff McIntyre could barely believe it when the giant monsters bizarrely lowered to the ground like a pair of obedient dogs.
Sit!
Incredibly, the hulking things did as he commanded, then patiently waited for further orders. His heart hammering painfully in his sore chest, McIntyre walked hesitantly toward them and reached out a hand to let the monsters sniff his scent.
Good boys. Good dogs.
McIntyre was already thinking of ways that he could use the massive escorts now that he was out in the world. The sheriff had always wanted a hunting dog, but none had survived the long winter years in Cascade without ending up as a roast on somebody's dinner table. Even the damn pigeons had been eaten, almost to the point of extinction. However, the sheriff now had two faithful companions, and from the looks of them, these were real killers, whatever the hell they were. Their former owner had to have gotten himself killed and they'd gone wild, but not feral, and had simply attached themselves to the first person they encountered. It was pure luck that it had been him. Once he found a new village to use as a home base, the sheriff planned to track down the one-eyed man and repay him for removing his eye. Then McIntyre would turn what remained of the bastard over to the dogs for their dinner. Roberto was the key, however. He would have to die first. But after that, the death of the one-eyed man was assured. Deathlands Eden's Twilight is a graphic audio production. Deathlands and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2009, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Dolores King Williams, Colleen Delaney, Nathan Bennett, Casey Platt, Michael Glenn, Lily David, Tim Getman, David Coyne, Jonathan Watkins, Kate Foster, James Lewis, Mort Shelby, Christopher Graybill, Sonny Lasky, Ken Jackson, Nanette Savard, and Michael Replogle. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Ken Jackson. Produced by Rick Rowan and Wayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton. Book adapted for graphic audio by Cheryl Hayes. Additional original music by Brian Patton and Nathaniel Perry. The Deathlands theme was composed by Mark Ashby. If you enjoyed Deathlands, be sure to look for James Axler's Outlanders and Earthblood, available at roadstops everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now in graphic audio. Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist, Midwake, Part 2.
Sonar's picking up Soviet scout subs, Captain. But, sir, it looks as though their own island-class submarines are pursuing them.
Sonar, talk to me.
Sir, I've got four Soviet scout subs proceeding at flank speed, but rather erratically. I have three island-class, correction, four island-class submarines in the classic Soviet pursuit formation. None of the island-class submarines is dragging a sonar array.
Very good, Lieutenant Kelly. Keep on.
First officer, order battle station.
Aye, sir. Ordering battle stations now.
Now hear this. Now hear this. All hands battle stations. Say again. All hands battle stations. This is not a drill.
Who the hell are you?
I am Captain Alexei Sarovsky of the Elite Corps of the Committee for State Security of the Soviet Union, under command of Hero Marshal Vladimir Karamazov. You are under arrest.
Sam!
Oh! Where are you supposed to bring me, Captain?
Comrade Major, have you no loyalty?
Oh, I have loyalty. But unlike your loyalty, it is not misplaced. This is a very fine knife, and I imagine it is very sharp. And if you know me by reputation, you know that I am very good with a knife. Either tell me where you are to meet Marshal Karamazov and when, or we will both find out together just how sharp this very knife happens to be.
You wouldn't.
Oh!
Karamazov! When land and sea collide, The Survivalist, Midwake, Part 2. Available now in graphic audio.
Serrano Legacy, Book 7, Against the Odds, Part 1, in graphic audio.
What?
Hands on your head.
Don't move.
What's going on?
I have orders to separate you from the regular space service as of today.
I haven't done anything wrong.
Fleet has no place for your kind.
Squeeza, Esme, most recent rank 03, separated by order of Admiral Serrano? Grandmother, she double-crossed us.
Bad news.
What?
Peter Origamos, Consuline's foreign minister. Mother, killed him.
Miranda, you can't expect me to let it go.
Damn and blast, Cecilia. The man had my husband killed. He was a despicable, slimy...
Leave the Familius. I'll take you.
Haltbreach! Haltbreach! Report all starboard aft teams.
Sir, we've got a peak our chem scan doesn't identify. Something with a molecular weight of 16.
16? Lieutenant, didn't I tell you to look out for methane?
Emergency! We have a potentially explosive gas mix.
Sir, I'm scared. I can't just stand here.
Sure you can. Smartest thing you can do.
No! Don't leave me behind!
No! Don't!
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include five books of a series, available only at www.graphicaudio.net.